We are in order, and this morning, the first bill that we're going to hear is going to be House Bill 2962. I see some faces that I associate with House Bill 2206, and we're going to be on the House floor here in about 20 minutes. So those of you who are waiting for that bill, if you want to come back, we're going to be back 9 o'clock-ish, something like that, to hear the rest of our bills. We're going to try and get House Bill 2962 done between now and the floor session, and I open a public hearing on that bill. Ellen, if you would please give us a brief synopsis.
Thank you, Chair Whitt, members of the committee. House Bill 2962, I would point out, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and what it does is requires the State Forestry Department to establish and maintain fuel breaks between contiguous state and federal forest lands. Fuel breaks are wide strips of land on which trees and vegetation have been permanently reduced or removed in order to stop the spread of wildfire.
Thank you very much. And our colleague, Representative Dahlem, is our first witness.
Thank you very much, Chair Whitt and fellow committee members. For the record, I'm Representative John Dahlem from House Bill 59. House Bill 2962 comes to you out of a sense of frustration shared with Bill Cluding and myself. The Black Crater Fire in Sisters, the Shake Table Fire at Mount Vernon, the Maxwell Fire at Mitchell, and before that, earlier, a couple of years, the B&B Fire at Sisters, are all in House District 59. All of them are federal forest fires that swept out of the federal forest and onto public and private land. Cost to the state, cost to the county, cost to other agencies, cities, in one case even a school district, but most importantly to private property are unmeasurable. This is a legitimate issue, and the question is, how can we get the Federal Forest Service to accept the responsibility for the loss that this state feels and that citizens of this state feel? I've worked with Paul Bell, Oregon Department of Treasury, and only last Wednesday did Paul suggest some amendments that may help this bill and that may make it work. I'm going to let him explain how those things will be. And if you have any question, I'm going to ask you to direct them to Paul or to Bill. And I'm going to sit here and look like I might know what they're talking about. Thank you for your patience with me.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Whitt and members of the committee. I'm Paul Bell, Forest Protection Division Chief for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2962. A major challenge for the Oregon Department of Forestry is providing effective wildfire protection when state and federal forest management objectives and legal mandates diverge. Management of private, state, and federal forests in Oregon was more similar in the past. However, after a long history of intensive management, timber harvesting on federal forests has declined dramatically. Much of Oregon's forested landscape is in second or third growth forests, which is actively intensively managed on most industrial timberlands and managed less intensively or not managed at all on most federal lands. Because of this difference in paradigms, some wildfires starting on federal lands tend to become more intense, become larger events, tie up shared firefighting resources, and occasionally burn onto ODF-protected lands, increasing our state's suppression costs and landowners' resource losses. As Representative Dahlem mentioned, in 2006, examples of these kinds of fires include the Black Crater Fire outside of Sisters, Shake Table Fire near Mount Vernon, the Maxwell Fire near Mitchell, the Foster Gulch Complex near Halfway, And in earlier years, fires such as the B&B just before the B&B fire in 2002, the Airlie fire, which burned in the Metolius drainage, started on Bureau of Indian Affairs lands, moved to Forest Service lands, and then moved off the Forest Service lands into state protected as well as non-protected lands, and eventually burned 18 homes in the Three Rivers area, as well as about 25 outbuildings. This bill would require the Oregon Department of Forestry to establish and maintain a 100-foot wide fuel break between federal forest lands and state protected forest lands. Our preliminary GIS analysis indicates that the statewide interface between these types of lands is about 35,000 miles. That approximation does not factor in the portions of the interface may already have some fuel breaks in place, such as rivers, natural land breaks and land types and that type of thing. So the area to treat would end up being probably somewhat smaller than that. Also, the bill provides no funding mechanism or authority to the state to implement these activities on private or local government lands. Many of the fires that originate on federal lands in eastern and southwest Oregon have fire behavior characteristics that these types of fuel breaks, are, unless strategically put in place, are not that effective at different times, because these kinds of fires end up spotting. The burn so intense, they'll spot out in front of themselves from half a mile to 2.5 miles out in front. The fuel breaks may provide some benefit if constructed in strategic locations to provide for holding activities for these large fires as they start moving in places to take suppression activity. Alternative strategies that would be more cost-effective and environmentally sound would be to invest in state actions that improve existing federal policy implementation targeted at restoring healthy forests and lessening the severity of these types of wildfires. A recent example of a successful shorter-term suppression strategy implemented through negotiations with the Forest Service is a concept we call the Rhine concept. This concept, while not appropriate for every fire, was successfully implemented in the case of the Maxwell fire, in which the state was able to take pre-suppression action, build fire lines, and start burnout operations on the private property line between the Forest Service. And the Forest Service paid for those suppression activities or reimbursed the state for that. So there is progress being made in this, and it is through negotiation with the Forest Service. Senate Bill 1072 passed in the last legislative session and codified NORS 526, established state policy regarding the relationship of the state forestry department with federal forest management and utilization of forest biomass. It also authorized the state forester to perform specific actions to increase state participation on federal forest management issues. Recognizing the seriousness and complexity of wildfires burning off of federal lands onto non-federal lands, the committee may wish to consider amendments to House Bill 2962 to widen the scope of the state forester's activities to include consideration of contracting fire suppression on national forest lands where it increases economic efficiency and effectiveness. This would be similar to fire prevention and suppression contract ODF already successfully performs in Western Oregon on Bureau of Land Management lands. The Department of Forestry, again, thanks the committee for the opportunity to testify on 2962, and thanks Representative Dahl for his attention to this issue. This has hit the Central Oregon area very hard, and we do need to try and work for solutions, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Dykesel, I'm the Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. I would concur with Mr. Bell's assessment and also appreciate Representative Dahlem bringing it to the attention of a broader audience. It has been a frustrating series of years dating back probably to around well, in my career down in Klamath Falls area in the mid-80s, where we had a lot of problems with interface fires and fires escaping federal lands. Another one that Mr. Bell did not mention was the Timbered Rock Fire down in southwest Oregon in 2002 that burned off federal lands and took a big chunk of Boise Cascade lands. They, on their own right, before their change in sale to Forest Capital Partners, installed several miles of fire line, as what's being described in the bill, on their own accord. And the sad part was is it took a number of acres out of production for sustainable forestry. The threat is basically on that side, is if you're willing to take those areas out of production, it also underscores the intent of the magnitude of what's going to come from federal lands onto private lands. We all, on our own behalf, working with the Department of Forestry last year, met with the leadership of Region 6 and also came up with a out-of-the-box thinking that would also allow for cost recovery for Forest Protective Associations and the Department of Forestry in initial attack actions on common boundaries that under the current master agreement were viewed as independent action. We clarified the fact that if, in fact, the Forest Service couldn't respond and keep the fires small, that those costs incurred by the local Forest Protective Associations were reimbursable. So that's the kind of things that we've been doing, and I would concur that the last couple of years have seen a marked improvement in cooperation and a little bit more of a response. I guess I'm here today to say thank Representative Dahlem and the department for their work in moving forward. If the bill doesn't change much, I guess I'd also like to be on record to say the implied fuel breaks that we're talking about are assumed to be on private and other lands, and I guess I would encourage the committee to think about the breaks actually being on their side of the line. Taking 420,000 acres of what the assessment ODF has done to how much area that fuel break would occupy, that's taking a huge chunk out of sustainably managed lands, and I would ask the committee to consider requiring the fuel break on their side of the line. And thank you for the ability to talk to the committee today.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Committee, for the record, Bill Flutting, Carpenters Industrial Council. This is what I call a strategy bill. It's just to draw more attention to a very serious problem we have in our forests. Hopefully, bills like this creates more meetings between Region 6 and our state foresters and our governor, our congressional leaders, in order to save what Oregon is noted for worldwide as beautiful, valuable forest. Also, in this, we're going to be creating jobs. And I know on the record you've heard me say this before, but that's what I'm here for, to create jobs for Oregon people. Stir up this economy. At the same time, save our forest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. it seems to me, and I like your point, we would stir up more conversation if we put in this bill that it's required to be on federal lands. I don't know that it would have any effect, but it would certainly stir up conversation.
We did, Representative Riley, we did check. In fact, one of the frustrating points when I went around the House floor, one of my colleagues said somewhat offhandedly, why don't we add to the bill that the federal government will pay for the fire line? And Bill and I started an amendment to do just that. We ran into an old agreement between the states and the federal government that precluded that, called the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And we also looked at a memorial. I think between the four of us there, and I don't want to imply that there's no cooperation, but the state of our federal forests does cost us, and it costs us dearly. In fact, Mr. Bell and I are looking. We may ask if we could refine an amendment that would help. We may be back, but we have time is short. We're very pleased that you gave us the opportunity to air this bill. If we can come up with an amendment that will do more than just raise the issue, we'll get the amendment drafted and come back.
Mr. Chair Lim.
Thank you very much. we do have a fire insurance policy for the state burning, when we successfully completed of this program, do you think we can negotiate with the fire insurance company to reduce the rate, because that will somehow reduce the burnings?
I'll tackle that in talking with the State Department of Forestry. As mentioned in testimony, we have common face with 35,000 miles of federal forest. And when you get into this, I have not drafted a bill in my time to learn, but I've seldom had one. I didn't learn a lot. And we have unconsolidated interests. The sheer magnitude of our common borders makes a solution or a solution difficult. So I think, Representative Lim, before we got into the insurance policy, we have to look at, I'm not sure that it would have an impact or not have an impact. And we are doing, I think, everything, and I'm looking at at the two forestry people. I think we're doing everything we can on the state level. One, to mitigate fire, and two, to reduce the cost of our insurance. I think that's a fair statement.
Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like a pretty big undertaking. I like the idea of, having a partnership with the federal government to have part of it on their land, if not all of it. But, maybe the Constitution is a partnership, so maybe they'd share that fire break. But it just occurs to me that this bill requires this fire break. Is there a possibility that somewhere there exists land, or maybe in the future there could exist land that doesn't require a fire break? If we were next to some beautifully maintained land on the federal forest at some point, maybe they get their act together in a couple of years and they clean up the entire federal forest. I wouldn't want to be locked into having to maintain a fire break if there really wasn't one needed. Just a thought. I don't know if the bill accommodates that or not.
Chair Witt, Representative Holy, if I can address that's precisely the point I'm trying to make within the testimony, is if the federal government can be successful in managing their forest or managing the forest in the interface and to be healthy, these types of fuel breaks aren't needed as much in those types of fuel types. I mean, if you have good, healthy timber in place, it's well-spaced and managed appropriately, fires can be controlled in those types of situations.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And when you are negotiating with the federal government, I hope also you can negotiate with the Washington State and California State, because fire, there's no boundary. It could start out Washington State or California or our state and move up to everywhere. So are you talking or negotiating with either states also?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, yes. We work very closely with all of our western states. The state forester belongs to the National Association of State Foresters, which has a western states coalition, and the fire managers for all of the western states are in close contact and coordination and working on the national level to address these management issues and fire issues also.
Thank you.
Mr. Bell, I wanted to follow up on Vice Chair Lim's first question. The state has a stop-loss fire insurance policy, I believe.
Chair Witt, the state does have a catastrophic fire insurance policy, which for this current fiscal year is for $25 million. The way that policy works is for reimbursement of costs to fight fires. It doesn't reimburse anything for resource losses or anything of that. To get into that insurance policy, we have to expend the $25 million deductible up front, which is $15 million of landowners' money, $10 million of state general fund before the insurance policy kicks in.
And Representative Dahlem, when you looked into the constitutional issues here. There's no way that we can send Uncle Sam a bill for fire costs, even when their reckless non-management policies of our federal forests cause private and state forests to burn.
Well, it comes on the other side of the equation. We can't do anything preventative. We do some things. I shouldn't say we can't do anything, but we have to wait till the fire and then ask for reimbursement. Okay. So we're on the back side of the issue rather than being proactive or reactive.
And Mr. Bell, is there any attempt by the State Department of Forestry to inform the federal government of our expectations for good neighborly conduct?
Chair Wett, most definitely. We are in constant negotiations with the Forest Service to keep them in tune with what is good forest management, good fire policy. And the Forest Service does work with us as partners, and they just have a lot of issues to work with.
Representative Dahlem, there have been suggested, yes, please.
Chair Wett, excuse the interruption, I just want to bring out that maybe there's a good opportunity to underscore the intent and the severity of the issue with the Federal Forest Land Advisory Committee that's currently meeting with the Department of Forestry and has a number of members that are dealing with how do we interact with the federal agencies. So that may be a good forum to help underscore this committee's level of frustration.
Representative Dahlem might like to represent this committee's general feelings on that topic. Representative Dahlem, you might also like to, if you choose to prepare a letter that expresses the sentiment of this committee to the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on, 29, House Bill 2962, and I'm going to recess this committee until after floor session.
Thank you very much.
Is it okay to leave our stuff here?
authority.
I've been told, Brad, when you're in the minority, you don't give any calls.
The House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development is back in session. Next on our agenda is House Bill 2264, and I will open a public hearing on that bill. Ellen, would you remind us what the what this bill does, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 2264, you should have some dash two amendments in the packets that Barry provided you. And with the dash two amendments, replace the entire bill and clarify that it's intended to exempt the Department of Education from the provisions of the Department of Administrative Services Procurement Code when they are procuring or supervising the procurement of goods, services, personal services, and information technology related to student assessment.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to call up, please, Morgan Allen and Nolan Campbell. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Education, and the committee administrator did a good job of explaining we are gutting and stuffing our own agency bill. As it was drafted by a legislative council, it had the unintended consequence of exempting the Department of Education, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the State Board of Education from the entirety of the public contracting code, which prompted several calls with from Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner and our friends from AGC and various labor unions who were quite alarmed by that. And that certainly was not our intention. And today we're bringing a dash two amendment, which we have worked with in drafting with the Department of Administrative Services. And you're getting a copy of my written testimony right now and a letter from the Department of Administrative Services stating their neutral position on the bill. So put quite simply, student assessments is really the basket of goods the department purchases or contracts for that relate to how students are tested and assessed to determine learning and to meet state standards and No Child Left Behind standards. And just to kind of give you a couple examples of what those assessments, those types of assessments and goods that we purchase. So it's online and paper assessment tests. It's publishing and printing literally test forms. It's contracting for technical assessment manuals. It can be the development of test questions and statewide assessments and content standards, conducting psychometric comparative analysis of test questions, and we also contract for things like the English language proficiency assessment. So the Dash 2 amendments would permit the Department of Education to procure or supervise the procurement of this basket of goods ourselves. Currently, like many other state agencies, we have to do that through the Department of Administrative Services. One thing to note, that all procurements that the department still does will conducted under the authority of the Dash 2 amendments, they still will be subject to the Public Contracting Code. They still will be subject to the Oregon State Procurement Code, and they're also still subject to all legal sufficiency reviews that come through the Attorney General's office. So this is the Dash 2 amendments are crafted very, very narrowly. And you might be asking, well, why do you guys want to be able to procure these goods and services yourselves rather than go through the Department of Administrative Services process? And the reality is No Child Left Behind. The testing mandates that the No Child Left Behind and the U.S. Department of Education place on the department and also that filter down to our school districts and schools sometimes require quick action. It's imperative that we have the ability to respond to these mandates quickly, and quite often the U.S. Department of Education will give a short notice, or their timelines that the federal government places on No Child Left Behind testing don't allow for any types of delays or take into consideration the sort of step-by-step processes that the Department of Administrative Services has built into the state procurement process. And when NCLB says jump, we frankly have to jump. There's a lot of federal money at stake. Those test scores, whether or not you agree with the mandates of No Child Left Behind, there are a lot of federal dollars at stake, and we need to make sure that we're meeting those demands of the federal government quickly. And currently, current DAS procurement procedures don't allow us to do this. I wanted to point out a couple things before. I've also brought with me Nolan Campbell, who's our department's chief procurement officer, who can answer any technical questions. But just to point out a couple other things quickly, many other agencies enjoy these types of limited procurement authority. As a matter of fact, in the Dash 2 amendments, when you see the department ad there, you'll notice like the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Human Services, the State Parks and Recreation Department, the Department of Aviation, the Department of Corrections, the Attorney General, and many other agencies enjoy these little sort of specialized carve-outs, niche procurement authorities. There's no cost to the department, no fiscal impact on the department, and frankly, it utilizes the procurement staff we already have on board. We have our top five senior procurement folks. We have our own procurement department at the Department of Education, and our top five procurement folks have over 70 years combined experience in these types of procurements. So, again, we've worked very closely with the Department of Administrative Services to draft an amendment that stays within the bounds of rules that they can live with and that allows us to react to the mandates of No Child Left Behind and other testing that we're required to do. So the Superintendent Castillo and the department would respectfully request that this committee adopt the Dash 2 amendments and send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And with that, we would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was about the department's experience with handling procurement, and I think it's been answered since I raised my hand. Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
In the last few weeks, we saw a contract dispute with the department and a test purchase, and I'm trying to draw a correlation between those two, and I won't miss this opportunity to look at you and say how you have crippled the schools across the state by forcing them to take a pen and pencil test and not working out your problem with the vendor. Now, is this going to help us with this problem, or is that going to make that, is this going to exacerbate that problem? And watching how you worked that problem with the vendor, and the only people that paid were the children of this state, I want an absolute guarantee that this is going to speed up or eliminate that problem. That was an abomination for our children.
Chair Witten, Representative Dahlem, the actual concept behind this bill and the folks in our procurement office had this bill drafted before we had any issues with our testing vendor, Vantage. And one thing I would like to point out is that it was the current Department of Administrative Services procurement rules and processes for RFPs and bids that disqualified Vantage Learning from going forward in the RFP process and continuing to be our vendor, which sort of led to the other issues. And I would let Mr. Nolan answer that question directly, but this is an issue that is not directly related to the Vantage and TESA issue, not directly related to the pencil and paper tests that our students are going to have to take this year. So I don't have a good answer to your question, but the issue of procurement rules, we would still be under the same DASH procurement rules that got us helped create the issue with our vendor. So I don't think that changes, and I could not offer you a guarantee that something like that would never happen again with the vendor if this bill passed. And I hope that the committee would look at it as a separate issue. It's really a separate issue in our minds. And so that I know that's probably not the answer that you were hoping for, and I understand your concerns and would be happy to have any of our procurement folks or folks at the department speak to you about that anytime you'd like.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify today on House Bill 2264? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on the bill and open a work session on House Bill 2264. Committee members, this is the second time we have heard this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Did we hear the opinions from the DAS on this issue?
Yes, in the first hearing, Ellen, I believe we heard from DAS the first time.
We have a letter from DAS that was brought by this witness.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Riley.
So are we ready to move?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt DAS's amendment to the House Bill 2264.
Vice Chair Lim moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2264. Questions or discussion on the motion? Yes, Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I was sort of paying attention, and I just want to confirm that this is just in regard that this exclusion from the public contracting code is just in regards to the No Child Left Behind Act and providing the kind of technology and goods and services for student assessment is.
Chair Witt,
and that's to the extent of this authority.
Chair Witt, Representative Fulvey, with one slight modification, we would still be subject to all the public contracting code. It's only the DAS procurement authority that we're asking for the exemption for. We're not asking for exemptions to the Department of Administration of Services procurement rules or the public contracting code. Basically, we just want to be able to make these procurements in-house. That's the simple answer to your question.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions or comments?
Yes.
As long as we're on that topic, just to be absolutely certain, all the same rules apply as they would apply otherwise. The difference is that you'd make the decision in your own procurement office rather than having to bring DAS into the process for their decision.
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, for the record, I'm Nolan Campbell, Director of Procurement Services, and you stated it exactly correct.
Thank you.
Can I clear that up?
Thank you.
Anything further? Any objection to adopting the -2 amendments to House Bill 2264? I'm not seeing any. They stand adopted. Committee, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 2264 as amended to the floor with the 2-pass recommendations.
Thank you. Vice Chair Lim moves House Bill 2264 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Questions, comments, discussion on the motion? Representative Dahlem.
Yes, Chair, I'm going to give you a courtesy vote. I understand the concept behind the bill, but I am very concerned about the Department of Education's relationship with Vantage. The delay in TESA, and I'm not sure there's a correlation, and I want to be absolutely certain. I was under the impression that because the Department of Ed had to go through this process, they couldn't negotiate with Vantage, and I can't explain to you the depth of the problem that not being able to work with Vantage caused the students of our state, so I want to be sure there's absolutely no correlation, and for that reason, I'm going to give you a courtesy vote.
Thank you very much, Representative Dahlem. Anything further on the motion? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. And maybe I need to ask a question in aid of my comment. It's my understanding that the department, through the current process, has entered into a new contract with a different vendor for these testing services for the next couple of years at least. Is that right?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, that is correct. We have a contract for the next 5 years, or up to 5 years, with American Institutes for Research, and that was developed with DAS authority. DAS actually was in charge of the procurement, and we aided in that process. Under these new rules, we would do the entire process, and in fact, we would take over that existing contract from DAS's contract administrative authority.
All right. Let me follow up with that. So the major piece of the work for this assessment process for the next several years has already been done. Is that right? Or are there some major decisions involving procurement yet to be made in the after the time this bill will go into effect and before the passage of 5 years from now?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, the major or the largest dollar contract under this service has been awarded. That is part of the process, but of course the administration of the process takes quite a bit of work too, and that's where actually disputes are more likely to occur in that part of the process.
Right.
So there are many other portions of the work that are also going to be portions of testing that still have to be done. So this isn't the only contract to do, but it is correct to say that the largest dollar contract has already been awarded.
If I may continue, please. Thank you. So I'm going to try to ask this one very carefully if I can.
Okay.
I suspect that it's your opinion that you can reduce the likelihood of the kinds of disputes that we have recently seen if you have fewer steps in the process, fewer people involved in the process, and more direct involvement within the department. Is that a reasonable statement of your views?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, that is a reasonable statement of my views, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that really sums up what I wanted to say about the motion. I suspect, and of course we don't know what all the facts are. Presumably, the court's going to figure that out on the old case. The facts, as I understand them, put substantial responsibility on the part of the company that apparently failed to comply with the contracting arrangements that it had. The issue of whether or not it was going to get a contract for a new period of time is irrelevant to the issue of whether it needed to fulfill its contract during the time that it was under contract, and the department's position is that it failed to do that. I see no reason to disagree with the department's position. I think this bill actually makes it less likely that we'll get into this kind of conflict in the future, and we ought to pass it.
And Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, if I could just clarify this to you, the concept for doing this was a bill that we had pre-session filed last fall, well in advance of any issues with disruption of online TESA testing. So this idea to give our folks in our in-house procurement shop the ability to negotiate these contracts directly and work with the vendors directly rather than going through the extra steps at the Department of Administrative Services was a separate idea before any issues with the testing, and it is obviously, the testing issue has arisen since then, and so that's germane to this bill. But I just want to make it very clear that this bill is not in response to anything that happened with Vantage or TESA. So.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Your line of questioning and the department's answer gives me a little added confidence here.
I want to the pre-filing certainly puts me at ease, but then and following up on Representative Barnhart's issue, it may be to the Department of Education's advantage to be an arm's length away from that process. Because now there is somebody between them and the vendor that can stand up and say, this is not the Department of Ed's fault. And that's the reason that I'm going to give you a courtesy vote. I want to be absolutely certain that I'm not setting us up for another situation that would exacerbate the fallout. So I'm looking at this just a little bit differently. Sometimes there is an advantage to having someone between you and your vendor when the dispute arises. So I'm going to stay with the courtesy vote, and thank you for your indulgence.
Vice Chair Lim.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe with this bill that we gave the department more responsibility. Yes. I think that there is less chance to finger-pointing someone else. I think that's a good thing. And instead of going every contract, going through the desk, they might be able to negotiate directly.
Yes.
And then save time and save a lot of energies. So I think this is already many other department agents, they are doing it. And only we are adding the Department of Education to this long list. So I think this is a good deal.
I do too. And if they mess up this time, Vice Chair Lim, we know where they live.
Exactly.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Just very quickly, this is a specialized kind of issue that the department certainly has expertise on. Unlike the procurement of many other kinds of things, where we expect DAS to have expertise and be purchasing for many, many departments the same kinds of materials and equipment and supplies and so forth. This is a specialized area. There are times when central control is valuable and important, and other times when local control is important. This is one of those local control issues.
It certainly is. Anything further on the motion? On the question, Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye. Courtesy, aye.
Representative Drott?
Excuse?
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Vice Chair Lim?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. House Bill 2264, having received the majority vote, is declared passed and sent to the floor. Gentlemen, I realize, Representative Dahlem, that you've had some misgivings. Is there any objection to a consent calendar for this bill?
I would, if my misgivings are resolved, and I'm sure they will be, I would carry the bill.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
And Representative Dahlem will be carrying the bill. And with that, I'm going to close the work session.
It's a courtesy carry.
It's a courtesy carry.
But listening to Representative Barnhart's discussion and the fact that the bill was pre-filed, I'm certain that my angst is with the people. Probably the association is not as tight as it should be for the diatribe you heard, but okay. If all those things are resolved, you'll hear a glowing report.
Thank you very much, Representative Dahlem. The public work session on House Bill 2264 is closed. Committee members, we're going to have a work session now on several bills, and just to remind you that each of the remainders has a subsequent to joint ways and means. With that, I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3223. And Ellen, if you could please remind us about that bill.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3223 and its companion bill 3224 relate to the Olympic track and field trials that will be held in Eugene. 3223 appropriates $300,000 from the general fund to the Department of Administrative Services for distribution to the city of Eugene for security costs. And House Bill 3224 directs the State Parks and Recreation Department to do some upkeep and infrastructure along the Willamette corridor, and there have been amendments that have been submitted to that bill to clarify whose responsibilities those will be.
Did we have anyone that wanted to add anything to the record while we're in work session on 3223? Do you know, Ellen?
Yes, I believe there's...
If you come forward. I'm going to also open the work session on 3224 as well.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm a legislative analyst for the City of Eugene. Keep my testimony very brief here. We've reviewed the Dash 2 amendment to 3224, which does deal with a minor change in where that money is sourced from. There was a public hearing earlier where testimony from the State Parks and Recreation Department was expressing some concern about the timeliness, I believe, of their grant program. And so this change, I believe, addresses that. And the City of Eugene obviously is supportive of both of these bills, and we urge a due pass recommendation, as you'll see in my testimony.
Thank you very much. Was there anything else?
Yes, if I may.
Please, Representative Barnhart.
We've got two amendments, the dash two and the dash three on House Bill
3224.
And I looking at them quickly, I can't see any difference between the two. I'm sure there is one, but I can't find it.
Chairwitt, Representative Barnhart, I too struggled with that. And if you look, I believe the only difference is a shall and a may on the left.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. You're right. Thank you. One word difference.
And I'm sorry, I don't have the dash.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think they're two different things.
I don't have the dash to come in. Good.
If we hold on, in your prepared packets, the large folder, Vice Chair Lim, that Barry prepared for us.
It's the very last one in the packet.
Chair, if I may, I'd like to amend my testimony and support the dash 3 amendment rather than the dash 2 amendment.
I'm glad I asked the question.
You may amend your statement. So it's the dash 3 that you that you're supporting.
That, I think that I believe it would provide a little bit more certainty for the measure. Yes.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Just so I understand, there are no amendments proposed for 3223.
That's the chair's understanding, Helen.
Chair, okay. Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Just one quick point. These bills go to Ways and Means. That's appropriate.
Yes.
I think I'm a co-sponsor on at least the first one, maybe the second one, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And I wanted to make it clear for the record that while I certainly support these bills, I certainly think that this is a very worthy use of state funds to help showcase the state of Oregon at the trials. It also is important to note that the state faces many difficult and serious funding problems in this biennium, as it will, until we actually get tax reform that restores our revenues to the levels we have to have in order to adequately fund state services. And that being the case, I expect the Ways and Means Committee, and I know they will put this into the hopper and compare the expenditures in these bills to the rest of the budget and act accordingly.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Committee members, yes.
And Mr. Chair, I totally agree with Representative Barnhart's statement there about, you know, the real trials of getting this through the Ways and Means process as our budget currently stands. But I'm hopeful that we'll get the revenue going forward and really think that the state should take a close look at funding this. This is an investment that will definitely pay the state back in terms of economic impact to our entire region. So I'm very hopeful Ways and Means, when the revenue does appear, that they look favorably upon both these bills.
Was that the Olympic trials that you were referencing, Representative Bolby?
Yes, Chair Witt, you've got that right.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bourne.
Thank you. I just simply wanted to add that I agree completely with the remarks of the representative from South Eugene.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and I am on signed on to both these bills, as is Representative Barnhart,
yes,
for his information.
Yes.
Chair Witt, would you mind if I made one more comment?
Please feel free.
I would like to just add that the state will become a partner if they do make this funding with a great deal of private interest in this event, as well as investment from the city of Eugene and Lane County. I know has already appropriated money for the event to assist with it happening. So we really do see, I know we've actually received a small amount of federal money through EPA to assist, so there are a great many. The state won't be the only funding source that this event is relying on to pull it off.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley, did you have something?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the Dash 3 amendment.
Vice Chair Riley moves adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3224. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
And what is 3224 and also 3223? I think the total appropriation is about a half million, close to half million dollars, I guess, or $600,000.
That's what I'm remembering from the first hearing.
Of course, this is going to the Ways and Means.
Of course.
And then my concern is this is a good bill and a worthwhile investment, but I'm concerned that so many agencies and programs asking for the general funds. And I want to make sure that we have some concerns in that, but I'm hoping the Ways and Means look at this issue, hopefully appropriate this. Some good amount of money.
Certainly.
For this economic development.
Certainly. Thank you very much. Further discussion on the Dash 3 amendments? I'm not seeing any. Is there any objection to that adoption? The Dash 3 amendments stand adopted to House Bill 3224. Committee members, before anyone makes a further move, for the clarity of the record, I am going to temporarily close the work session on House Bill 3224. What's your pleasure on House Bill 3223?
Mr. Chair, I think we adopted the amendment to House Bill 3224, and we need to close the work session on 3223 and reopen 3224.
I'm just going in numerical order. Yes.
Okay.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3223 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 3223 to the floor with a subsequent to Joint Ways and Means. Yes, Representative Dahlem.
I'm going to say this is a good bill, and I know that we have to go to Ways and Means first, and we'll never see the opportunity for this to come to revenue because the revenue will be vicarious. We have to make an investment that we're going to see, and we're going to get revenue that we won't get to book. But I, in my own mind, am absolutely convinced that the revenue, although indirect, will far exceed the expenditure. The unfortunate thing is we have to do the revenue, the expenditure now, and the revenue in the future. But that's the nature of an investment. I'm going to support this bill. I think it's good for the state. I come from a completely different part of the state, and I can see advantage for us even. So I am a very strong supporter of this bill.
I will be willing to bet there will be a number of tourists that make it through the Columbia River Gorge during that time.
Well, first, maybe this.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
This is simply a response to Representative Dahlem, a suggestion that he forthwith contact the state economist and make certain that the economic projections for the next 2 years reflect the revenue that's going to be produced by this bill, these two bills. I agree with your comments completely about the nature of the way in which we do the bookkeeping on these things. We will never separately account for the income. We will have to account for the expenditure.
Okay. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Lim.
Well, this is a good bill, and I believe this will bring the economic development and some jobs. And I just want to comment, I also introduced the Winter Olympic Game sometime in the future. And if you vote this bill, you got to vote my bill, too.
Very good. further discussion? Not seeing any. On the question, Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Dowell?
Aye.
Representative
Drott? Excused.
Representative Holdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lynch?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received a majority vote, House Bill 3223 is sent to Joint Ways and Means. Thank you. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3223 and reopen the work session on House Bill 3224.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we send House Bill 3224 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Representative Holvey moves House Bill 3224 as amended to the floor with a subsequent to Joint Ways and Means. And discussion on the motion. Yes, Vice Chair Riles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the only person, I think, on the committee who doesn't have a sports bill, I still think that this is a great bill and that we need to pass it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Further discussion? Not seeing any. Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Dallin?
Aye.
Representative Drott?
Excused.
Representative Holvey?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lynn?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the majority vote, House Bill 3224 is referred to Joint Ways and Means, and I will close the work session on that bill. All right. Next on our agenda. What did the chair do with the agenda?
2206.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryle. I mean, Lim. Next, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2206. And Ellen, if you would please refresh our memory on this bill, not that we probably need it. But
thank you, Chair. What members of the committee? House Bill 2206 establishes the Skill Up Oregon Fund in the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And you have a number of amendments. You have amendments 1 through 6. And in your packet, there should be a chart that I put together to hopefully provide a little bit of help in sorting through the amendments. Those who lost their chart, there's one blown up in front of you, and perhaps for the viewers at home so that they can also see what we're talking about.
Okay,
chart.
Who is it?
I had one a few minutes ago.
The committee will stand at ease just momentarily here.
No chart in
the paper shuffle.
One up there.
Our administrator, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or our assistant. Yes, you have the.
Okay. Can you make us some copies? We'll just stand at ease here for a moment, committee members.
It's not right there. Is this the last thing we need to work on today?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
All right, committee members, we're back on the record here. Ellen, could you assist us in deciphering the differences between the various dash amendments?
Yes. So the first row of amendments, the first row on this chart, talks about there were amendments that were made to expand the eligible providers of training with whom the local boards could contract. So the dash one specified that the local boards can contract with regionally accredited education providers to provide the training. The dash twos expanded that to say that local boards could contract with regionally accredited education providers and providers who were on the eligible provider training list, which is maintained by the Department of Community Colleges. And the dash six amendments incorporate the dash two amendments changes with regard to regionally accredited education providers and providers who are on the eligible provider training list maintained by the department. The second row deals with a set aside of some of the skill up monies that would be allocated to in the dash four amendments. They'd be allocated to the Bureau of Labor and Industries Apprenticeship and Training Council. In the dash five amendments, that 10% set aside was, instead of being directly funded to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, it was flowed into a separate apprenticeship support account, and the total monies could not exceed $4 million. The dash five amendments, 10% set aside with the monies not to exceed $4 million, is incorporated in the dash six amendments. And I guess I should say at this point, all of the previous amendments have been incorporated into the dash sixes, so that if you all agree with the policy decisions that are reflected in the dash six amendments, you could simply adopt the dash six amendments, and it incorporates all of the prior changes. The third row deals with what type of awards that can come out of this apprenticeship support account, which is the one that is funded with 10% of the set-aside, not to exceed $4 million. In the Dash 4 iteration, the council can award grants to construction and manufacturing apprenticeship programs. In the Dash 5 amendments, a determination was made that the council should only be able to award those grants to applicants who agreed to match the monies. And then it also expanded the uses that the grant funds could be used for. In the Dash 6 amendments, the policy decision is that the grant applicants who agree to match monies are given preference so that the council can award grant monies to those who do not agree to match but are to be giving preference to those who do agree to match, and it also expands a list of those who may apply for grants so that school districts and others could apply for the grant monies that are in the apprenticeship support account. The fourth row talks about limitations on administrative costs. In the Dash 2 amendments, the administrative costs were limited for the department to those that are in the Federal Workforce Investment Act. In the Dash 3 amendments, a policy decision was made that the administrative costs should be limited for the department and the boards to the lesser of 10% of the total amount of monies distributed in any fiscal year or the limitations in the Federal Workforce Investment Act. The Dash 4 amendments incorporate the 10% limitation and the limitation in the Federal Workforce Investment Act. And then the Dash 6s limits the administrative costs for the department, for the apprenticeship support account, and to the grantees. It limits all of their administrative costs simply to those in the Federal Workforce Investment Act and leaves out the 10% administrative cost. And then finally, in the last row, you'll see that the Dash 2 amendments clarified that low-skilled workers, which are folks to whom these grants should be directed, that those low-skilled workers may be persons who formerly or currently receive public assistance. The Dash 6 amendments also incorporate that clarification.
Thank you very much, Ellen. For those of us who like simplicity, are there any of the amendments that subsume the rest or...
How can I simply pigeonhole six different amendments?
Thank you, Chair Witt. And here I thought I had simplified it. The Dash 6 amendments incorporate all of the previous amendments with two exceptions. On the second row, you'll see that the apprenticeship support account is funded with 10% of the total monies, not to exceed $4 million. And the limitation on not exceeding $4 million is not in the Dash 4 amendments. And then the other thing that is not incorporated is that grant applicants who agree to match monies are given preference in the Dash 5 amendments. The applicant actually has to agree to match the money or they're not eligible. Okay. So those are the only two differences, but the Dash 6 incorporates all of the other prior amendments.
That's what I thought. That's a great chart.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
That's very helpful.
Chair Witt, if I might ask, Ellen, I heard you say high schools as eligible grant recipients. I have not read that in any of the amendments to this point in time. How are they coming into this game?
Chair Witt, Representative Ellen, I'm sorry, the media was requesting that the chart be moved because the we were trying to get it for the viewers at home, but apparently it was blocking. So I'm sorry, I did not. I didn't hear
In your presentation, we talked about granting agencies, and I'm wondering if I do not see high schools as eligible grant recipients specifically named, but I heard you name them. Was that a slip of the tongue, or are high schools eligible grant recipients?
I believe if you look at the Dash 6 amendments and for the if you look at page 6 of the Dash 6 amendments, line 16, with regard to the apprenticeship support account, the council may award grants on a competitive basis to any of the following: apprenticeship and training programs that are registered with the council, school districts and education service districts, post-secondary educational institutions, not-for-profit organizations, and local or regional workforce investment boards. So I believe that the Dash 6 amendments make it possible for a high school to apply at least to the extent that the apprenticeship support account is funded.
And let me explain. At the community college level, the community college is not only going to apply for a grant, but we're going to get students into the system by paying up to $3,000 in tuition. And we're going to have the grant system also. So the community college is going to see skill-up money on two different venues. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Dellum, I think the answer to your question is that it would be possible for the community colleges to have somebody that qualified under skill-up that could receive up to $3,000 for their tuition, and that also could be eligible under the apprenticeship support account for those for monies also. But I think that Lita Colligan may be able to answer that question more effectively than I can.
Okay, thank you. Additional questions?
I would. That is true, isn't it?
Representative Dahlem, I'm actually okay. Now's a good.
I looked at. I think she shook her head. Yes, but
get that on the record. My intention was to have Lita come forward, anyways. Thank you for any assistance you may provide us.
For the record, I'm Lita Colligan, Workforce Advisor for Governor Kulongoski, and Chair Witt. And Representative Dahlem, I think the intent of these, the intent of the bill is to provide resources to the local workforce investment boards who would assess low-skill individuals and provide them with dollars to move them from a lack of skills into a targeted high-demand occupation. That's the overall intent of the bill. The, if you want to call it earmark, that we have on the bill now for 10% of the money to go to the Apprenticeship and Training Council is really about building the capacity of our apprenticeship system to work with the high schools better, to target diverse populations and other things like that. So if a college were applying for a grant to the Apprenticeship Council to do something related to expanding their apprenticeship, it would be more about the program, expanding a program, or working with alignment between a high school and a community college or something like that, rather than dollars flowing to individuals who would receive them sort of at two locations. Do you see the difference? One, the dollars follow the individual. The other is more about capacity building to overcome the barriers to students successfully transferring into apprenticeship, or to overcome the barriers of certain types of people getting into apprenticeships. I hope that's helpful.
If I might explain, Chair Witt, I'm looking through the prism of the student, prism of the agency, and then I'm drafting a letter that all of us will feel comfortable signing, which is turning out to be a daunting task. But then we have to have the community college, and this is ready with program. And three or four sessions ago, I explained that we must fund the community colleges so that these programs will be there mm-hmm. when these students arrive. And I am working on that letter, and I wanted to be sure that I understood these two nuances, and thank you very much, Lita.
Certainly.
Additional Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spent a little time on this Dash 6 amendment, and I'm pretty familiar with it, as Lita knows and others, and perhaps the Bureau of Labor and Industry, Steve Sims with the Apprenticeship and Training Division is also here. But just to help clarify the Dash 6 amendment in regards to Representative Dallum's question and Lita Colligan's response, which is basically correct, it just allows the Apprenticeship and Training Council to work with our schools and whatever, whether it's a high school or community college, they may determine that there's a great program, they being the Apprenticeship and Training Council, that a community college or a high school has, and so it allows them to partner with that and for that school to also get money out of that apprenticeship fund special account, I guess. But again, that goes through the Apprenticeship and Training Council and its mission to build that skilled workforce in the construction industry and other types of apprenticeable industries that we do have in the apprenticeship division. So it's really all about what really brought this to mind was the program that the Department of Education and Apprenticeship and Training Division were working on to do some outreach into the high schools, and that pilot program that they expressed an interest in, that we've seen some great results in other states with that kind of model, and trying to build the capacity as Ms. Culligan described, and also, you know, to help train that skilled workforce that we desperately need. So I think this Dash 6 amendment accomplishes a small piece of this, because I didn't really see where that kind of program was going to get any funding at all this session, and so that was the motivation behind setting up this separate 10% piece of this. And I just also wanted to touch base on the first column also where it says and provider. I think in the bill it's actually or. It doesn't have to be both with and. I just want to, you know, clarify that it could be either or, an education provider or an eligible providing training list, just to clarify that for the committee as well. And there was also a difference on the administrative cost on line 4 that was in the dash 3 and 4 that's not in the Dash 6. I just left the administrative cost to the limitations on the Federal Workforce Investment Act. I got worried about having a conflict that may have an unintended consequence for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development down the road. So I became uncomfortable with that notion. And I know that they are going to be very frugal with their monies anyway. So I just wanted to comment on that aspect of it, too. I think this is a great opportunity for us if we can get the funding that will drive this skill-up fund I think this is a great step for our workforce development and the Skill Up Fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like Steve Sims, if I could ask you to join Lita, please. We might benefit from both of your insights here. Representative Dahl?
I thought maybe that was Community College representative coming through the door. I might say the grants to the Community College is above and beyond any Community College allocation. And I want to pursue something that Representative Hovey has talked about, and that's grants to high schools. I think it's imperative that we have a connection. Coming from the other end of the dais on the educational performance, I think one of the problems that we have to address at some point in time is exposure. And we heard that from out there, that our high school kid students, and I guess they are a basic product of our Skill Up program, if you look at it that way. And I think we do need some way to encourage a look at our trades by our high school students. I'm not sure this is as direct as I would like, but it's a start. And I'm going to be in support of this program, but I'm going to want to add a little more later on.
And I think I saw one of our other members here to my left, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain to me page 2, for administrative costs, the amount of money used by the department or the council for administrative costs may not exceed the limitation of federal workforce investment. What are we talking about? What percentage and how much is it?
The current percentage, Chair Witt and Representative Lim, the current percentage of that's a limitation of the Federal Workforce Investment Act is 5%.
Okay. Additional questions?
Yes.
And I don't see any total amount of the funding. How much is the total amount of funding? I couldn't find in the amendment, in the original deal.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, the governor included $10 million based on a corporate minimum tax increase in his budget, and this is currently not included in the co-chair's budget, but that was the request that was made through the governor's budget. It was for $10 million biannually. So the 10% would mean $1 million going into the apprenticeship fund to provide assistance to overcome barriers, including the types of things that Representative Dahlen brought up of exposure of students to apprenticeship information. That's what the $1 million would go for, and then the other $9 million would travel to the workforce investment boards to do the assistance for low-skill individuals.
But my question is currently, the corporation tax has not been increased.
Right.
So what happens if there is no increase? If it doesn't happen, then what happens? Let's kill up.
Yeah. Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I think then that we would have a policy that says we support low-skill worker training, but we would not have the money to implement it.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart. This is really a follow-up, but it's a comment, and that is that this illustrates one more reason why the Revenue Committee needs to get busy and send a corporate minimum tax bill to the floor. Thank you.
I certainly don't want to read too much into Ms. Culligan's last statement, nor
no,
do I want to put words in her mouth.
That's my comment, not hers.
But I think that the fact that we would be supporting a policy of low-skill training may speak paragraphs there. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make one more clarification on this bill as I read it and the intent of the bill on the $4 million that you see on the chart. That $4 million cap as such is a cap of the monies that come from the Skill Up Fund. It doesn't mean that the apprenticeship support account can't get additional monies from other federal or local government funds or from any other source, actually. I'm a little concerned that it's construed to mean that apprenticeship support account can't exceed $4 million. That's not the intent, I believe, of the bill, the language doesn't really say that specifically. I just wanted to point that out for clarification and for the record.
Thank you, Representative Holby. The discussion. Could I ask for both of your comments on the amendments?
Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, Stephen Sims, the administrator of the Apprenticeship and Training Division. I think on behalf of the State Apprenticeship Council and the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we are supportive of the -6 amendments to this bill for a variety of reasons. I'd like to touch briefly on some of the issues raised, and the first is the potential issue of community colleges receiving duplicate funding under the skill up portion of the bill and also the apprenticeship support fund account. And I think it's important to remember that the skill up bill is intended to work with those individuals who need basic skills in order to enter our workforce, basic workforce readiness. And the community college does an excellent job in working in those areas. Because apprenticeship at the end offers very well paying jobs that pay in excess of the state median income, they offer careers, we're not looking for people who have basic skill readiness. We want people who are prepared to enter these jobs. Many times when people get to that level, they need specific introductions to the trade, training in trade math, training in those skills that are specific to the manufacturing, industrial, and construction trades. That's the type of thing, programs that enhance that training are what we're looking to fund through the apprenticeship support account. In many cases, that might mean granting funds to existing apprenticeship committees to improve and expand some of their pre-skill training that they run out of their own training center, expanding upon their limited programs right now in high schools, expanding opportunities that we at the Bureau have identified to work with high schools, such as our pilot project. With respect to community colleges, I'll give you one example. There's an approved pre-apprenticeship program approved by the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council that at Portland Community College, their Cascade campus in North Portland. They work specifically with African-American males. African-American males have the highest unemployment rate in the state, and their highest concentration is in North Portland. They need not only specific skill training, but also training with understanding the environment of the construction industry, understanding that you get up at 4:30 so you can be on the job site at 6, understanding that being late is not appropriate. It's a comprehensive program that is housed in a community college, and it has relationships with individual apprenticeship committees. Even though that's housed at a community college, should the council choose to divert grant money to that program to expand it, that's not duplicative of anything that came from the Skill Up Fund. Individuals who entered that pre-apprenticeship program may have gotten assistance through services delivered by the community college through Skill Up funding, but no, this is something completely separate and distinct. I think the thing that we do with this account, the State Apprenticeship Council and the Apprenticeship Division does not have program money per se. So when we're approached by school districts saying we would really like to put together this program to work with apprenticeship and introduce people to the trade, but we don't have any money for curriculum, the apprenticeship committees and their training directors are willing to help us, but we don't have any money to develop the curriculum. Can you give us some assistance? When we hear from school districts saying we would like to do regular site visits followed up with some classroom instruction in the trades, but we can't afford transportation, this fund would allow us to do that. It allows us to, the model is similar to what the old Economic Development Department's model was. We don't fund the whole project, but we create the leverage funding that will make it happen. That's what we hope to do with this fund, and I think our focus will complement what is going on with our pilot programs already. So on behalf of Commissioner Gardner and the State Apprenticeship Council, we heartily support the -6 amendments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sims. Before I lose two of my committee members, we need to determine here very quickly if we're going to adopt any of these dash amendments. Vice Chair Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash six amendments to this bill.
Vice Chair Riley moves the dash six amendments to House Bill 2206. Are there any objections? Seeing none, hearing none, they are adopted. Vice Chair Riley?
Mr. Chair, I move that we send the this bill,
House Bill 2206.
House Bill 2206 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Riley moves House Bill 2206 with the dash six amendments to the floor with a subsequent to Joint Ways and Means. On the question, discussion, not seeing any. Barry, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Drott?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lim?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the majority vote, House Bill 2206, as amended, is moved to the floor with a subsequent to House Joint Ways and Means. Let's see. Representative Holby, would you like to carry that bill?
Well, I don't think I can carry it in Ways and Means, but I'd love to do it anyway.
I'm sorry. Here, missed that one. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2206, and I am going to adjourn the committee. Thank you very much.
We might be more successful if we assign the carrier.
Well, we might be.